is not a pretty picture. For many Americans, the golden years are likely to be extremely grim. Boomers approaching retirement, who wish to avoid a life of privation, have only two realistic choices. They can begin saving in a serious way. Alternatively, they can beat the odds and die early. As Henny Youngman used to say, I've got all the money I'll ever need if I die by 4 o'clock. For readers who find themselves in the situation I have described, I have no easy answers. You have no alternative but to work during your retirement years and to control expenses and save as much as possible. But there is a bright side even for you. There are many part-time jobs that can be done from home thanks to the Internet. And there are psychological and health benefits to working in retirement. Those who do some work have a better feeling of self-worth and connectedness. And they are also healthier. Indeed, I would recommend that everyone should delay retirement as long as possible and put off taking Social Security until full retirement age, so as to maximize annual benefits. Only for those in very poor health, with a short life expectancy, would I recommend starting to take benefits at the earliest age at which you can start to collect. Investing a retirement nest egg. If you've been prescient enough to save for your retirement, what investment strategies will help ensure that your money lasts as long as you do? There are two basic alternatives. First, one can annuitize all or part of one's retirement nest egg. Second, the retiree can continue to hold his investment portfolio and set up a withdrawal rate that provides for a comfortable retirement while minimizing the risk of outliving the money. How should one decide between the two alternatives? Annuities. Sturgeon's Law, coined by the science fiction writer Theodore Sturgeon, states 95% of everything you hear or read is crap. That is certainly true in the investment world, but I sincerely believe that what you read here falls into the category of the other 5%. With respect to the advice regarding annuities, I suspect that the percentage of misinformation is closer to 99%. Your friendly annuity salesman will tell you that annuities are the only reasonable solution to the retirement investment problem. But many financial advisors are likely to say, don't buy an annuity, you'll lose all your money. What's an investor to make of such diametrically opposite advice? Let's first get straight what annuities are and describe their two basic types. An annuity is often called long-life insurance. Annuities are contracts made with an insurance company where the investor pays a sum of money to guarantee a series of periodic payments that will last as long as the annuitant lives. For example, during mid-2014, a $1 million premium for a fixed lifetime annuity would purchase an average annual income stream of about $68,000 for a 65-year-old male. If a 65-year-old couple retired and desired a joint and survivor option that provided payments as long as either member of the couple was alive, the $1 million would provide fixed annual payments of about $59,000. Of course, with any inflation, the purchasing power of those payments would tend to decrease over time. For that reason, many people prefer to purchase variable annuities. Variable annuities provide the possibility of rising payments over time depending upon the type of investment assets, typically mutual funds, chosen by the annuitants. If the annuitant chooses common stocks, the payments will rise over time if the stock market does well, but they will fall if the stock market falters. Annuities can also be purchased with a guaranteed payment period. A 20-year guaranteed period means that even if you die immediately after purchasing the annuity, your heirs will receive 20 years of payments. Of course, the annuitant will pay for that guarantee by accepting a substantial reduction in the dollar amount of the annual payments. The reduction for a 70-year-old male is likely to be over 20%. Thus, if you are really bothered by the possibility of dying early and leaving nothing behind, it's probably better to scale back the proportion of your retirement nest egg used for an annuity purchase. Variable annuities provide one approach to addressing inflation risk. Another possibility is an annuity with an explicit inflation adjustment factor. For example, the Vanguard Group offers an annuity with an explicit inflation consumer price index adjustment up to 10% per year. Such a guarantee will naturally lower the initial payment substantially, A 65-year-old couple desiring a joint and survivor option would find that $1 million would provide an initial annual payment of only about $42,000 per year. Annuities have one substantial advantage over a strategy of investing your retirement nest egg yourself. The annuity guarantees that you will not outlive your money. If you are blessed with the good health to live well into your 90s, it is the insurance company that takes the risk that it has paid out to you far more than your original principal plus its investment earnings. Risk-averse investors should certainly consider putting some or even all of their accumulated savings into an annuity contract upon retirement. What then are the disadvantages of annuities? There are four possible disadvantages. Annuitization is inconsistent with the bequest motive. It gives the annuitant an inflexible path of consumption. It can involve high transaction costs, and it can be tax inefficient. 1. Desire to leave a bequest. Suppose a retiree has saved a substantial nest egg and can live comfortably off the dividends and interest from the investments. While an even larger amount of yearly income could be provided by annuitization, there would be no money left over for bequests when the annuitant dies. Many individuals have a strong desire to be able to leave some funds for children, relatives, or eleemosynary institutions. Full annuitization is inconsistent with such bequest motives. 2. Flexibility of consumption. Suppose a couple retires in good health at age 65 and purchases an annuity that pays a fixed sum each year as long as either partner is alive. Such a joint life annuity is a common way for couples to structure their retirement. But right after signing the contract with the insurance company, both husband and wife learn that they have incurable diseases that are highly likely to reduce the period each will survive to a precious few years. The couple might reasonably want to take the around-the-world trip they had always dreamed of. Annuitization gives them no flexibility to alter their path of consumption if circumstances change. 3. Annuities can be costly. Many annuities, especially those sold by insurance agents, can be very costly. The purchaser pays not only the fees and expenses of the insurance company, but also a sales commission for the selling agent. Some annuities can thus be very poor investments. 4. Annuities can be tax inefficient. While there are some advantages to fixed annuities relative to bonds in terms of tax deferral, variable annuities turn preferentially taxed capital gains into ordinary income subject to higher tax rates. Also, partial annuitization of retirement account assets does not offset the required minimum distributions, RMDs, you must take. If you annuitize 50% of your IRA, you still have to take RMDs on the other half. This is no problem if you are spending at least that total amount, but tax inefficient if you are not. So what should smart investors do? Here are my rules. At least partial annuitization usually does make sense. It is the only no-risk way of ensuring that you will not outlive your income. Reputable companies such as Vanguard offer annuities with low costs and no sales commissions. In order to make sensible decisions on annuities, you should do some comparison shopping on the Internet at www.valic.com. You will find considerable variation in rates from different providers. The do-it-yourself method. Many retirees will prefer to keep control of at least a portion of the assets they've saved for a retirement nest egg. Let's suppose the assets are invested with a bit more than half in equities and the rest in income-producing investments. Now that you are ready to crack open the nest egg for living expenses in retirement, how much can you spend if you want to be sure that your money will last as long as you do? I suggested in previous editions that you use the 4% solution. In the 9th edition of this book, I recommended a 4.5% rule because bond yields were considerably higher than they were in 2014. Indeed, with interest rates as low as they are, a 3.5% rule would give retirees even more assurance that they would not outlive their money. Under the 4% solution, you should spend no more than 4% of the total value of your nest egg annually. At that rate, the odds are good that you will not run out of money even if you live to 100. It is highly likely, too, that you will also be able to leave your heirs with a sum of money that has the same purchasing power as a total of your retirement nest egg. Under the 4% rule, you would need $450,000 of savings to produce an income in retirement of $1,500 per month or $18,000 per year. Why only 4%? It is highly likely that a diversified portfolio of stocks and bonds will return more than 4% in the years ahead, but there are two reasons to limit the takeout rate. First, you need to allow your monthly payments to grow over time at the rate of inflation. Second, you need to ensure that you could ride out several years of the inevitable bear markets that the stock market can suffer during certain periods. Let's see first where the 4% figure comes from. We suggested on page 346 that stocks might be expected to produce a long-run rate of return of about 7% per annum. A diversified bond portfolio, including bond substitutes, is likely to produce something like a 4% return. Hence, we can project that a balanced portfolio of half stocks and half bonds should produce approximately a 5.5% return per year. Now, suppose that over the long pull, the inflation rate is 1.5%. That means that the corpus of the investment fund will have to rise by 1.5% a year to preserve its purchasing power. Thus, in a typical year, the investor will spend 4% of the fund, and the nest egg will grow by 1.5%. Spending in the following year can also grow by 1.5% so that the retiree will still be able to buy the same market basket of goods. By spending less than the total return from the portfolio, the retiree can preserve the purchasing power of both the investment fund and its annual income. The general rule is, first, estimate the return of the investment fund, and then deduct the inflation rate to determine the sustainable level of spending. If inflation is likely to be 2% per year, then a 3.5% spending rate would be more appropriate. There is a second reason to set the spending rate below the estimated rate of return for the whole fund. Actual returns from stocks and bonds vary considerably from year to year. Stock returns may average 7%, but in some years, the return will be higher, whereas in other years it might be negative. Suppose you retired at age 65 and then encountered a bear market as severe as the one in 2008 and 2009, when stocks declined by about 50%. Had you withdrawn 7% annually, your savings could have been exhausted in less than 10 years. But had you withdrawn only 3.5% or 4%, you would be unlikely to run out of money even if you lived to 100. A conservative spending rate maximizes your chances of never running out of money. So if you are not retired, think hard about stashing away as much as you can so that later you can live comfortably even with a conservative withdrawal rate. Three footnotes need to be added to our retirement rules. First, in order to smooth out your withdrawals over time, don't just spend 3.5% or 4% of whatever value your investment fund achieves at the start of each year. Since markets fluctuate, your spending will be far too uneven and undependable from year to year. My advice is to start out spending 3.5% or 4% of your retirement fund and then let the amount you take out grow by 1.5% or 2% per year. This will smooth out the amount of income you will have in retirement. Second, you will find that the interest income from your bonds and the dividends from your stocks are very likely to be less than the 3.5% or 4% you wish to take out of your fund. So you will have to decide which of your assets to tap first. You should sell from the portion of your portfolio that has become overweighted relative to your target asset mix. Suppose that the stock market has rallied so sharply that an initial 50-50 portfolio has become lopsided with 60% stocks and 40% bonds. While you may be delighted that the stocks have done well, you should be concerned that the portfolio has become riskier. Take whatever extra monies you need out of the stock portion of the portfolio, adjusting your asset allocation and producing needed income at the same time. Even if you don't need to tap the portfolio for spending income, I would recommend rebalancing your portfolio annually so as to keep the risk level of the portfolio consistent with your tolerance for risk. Third, develop a strategy of tapping assets so as to defer paying income taxes as long as possible. When you start taking federally mandated required minimum distributions from IRAs and 401ks, you will need to use these before tapping other accounts. In taxable accounts, you are already paying income taxes on the dividends, interest, and realized capital gains that your investments produce. Thus, you certainly should spend these monies next, or even first, if you have not yet reached the age of 70 and a half when withdrawals are required. Next, spend additional tax-deferred assets. If your requests are likely to be to your heirs, spend Roth IRA assets last. There is no required withdrawal for these accounts, and you can pass the assets to your heirs tax-free. No one can guarantee that the rules I have suggested will keep you from outliving your money. And depending on your health and other income and assets, you may well want to alter my rules in one direction or another. If you find yourself at age 80, withdrawing 4% each year and with a growing portfolio, either you have profound faith that medical science has finally discovered the fountain of youth, or you should consider loosening the purse strings. Chapter 15. Three Giant Steps Down Wall Street. From Charles Dickens, David Copperfield. Annual income, £20. Annual expenditure, 19.6. Result, happiness. Annual income, £20. Annual expenditure, £20, 0.6. Result, misery. This chapter offers rules for buying stocks and specific recommendations for the instruments you can use to follow the asset allocation guidelines presented in Chapter 14. By now you have made sensible decisions on taxes, housing, insurance, and getting the most out of your cash reserves. You have reviewed your objectives, your stage in the life cycle, and your attitude toward risk, and you have decided how much of your assets to put into the stock market. Now it is time for a quick prayer at Trinity Church and then some bold steps forward, taking great care to avoid the graveyard on either side. My rules can help you avoid costly mistakes and unnecessary sales charges, as well as increase your yield a mite without undue risk. I can't offer anything spectacular, but I do know that often a 1 or 2% increase in the yield on your assets can mean the difference between misery and happiness. How do you go about buying stocks? Basically, there are three ways. I call them the no-brainer step, the do-it-yourself step, and the substitute player step. In the first case, you simply buy shares in various broad-based index funds or indexed ETFs designed to track the different classes of stocks that make up your portfolio. This method also has the virtue of being absolutely simple. Even if you have trouble chewing gum while walking randomly, you can master it. The market, in effect, pulls you along with it. For most investors, especially those who prefer an easy, lower-risk solution to investing, I recommend bowing to the wisdom of the market and using domestic and international index funds for the entire investment portfolio. For all investors, however, I recommend that the core of the investment portfolio, especially the retirement portion, be invested in index funds or ETFs. Under the second system, you jog down Wall Street, picking your own stocks and perhaps overweighting certain industries or countries. This involves work, but also possibly a lot of fun. I don't recommend this approach for most investors. Nevertheless, if this is how you prefer to invest, I've provided a series of rules to help tilt the odds of success a bit more in your favor. Third, you can sit on a curb and choose a professional investment manager to do the walking down Wall Street for you. The only way investors of modest means can accomplish this is to purchase managed mutual funds. I don't prefer actively managed funds, but later in the chapter I will at least present some suggestions that may help you choose the better ones if you insist on this option. Earlier editions of my book described a strategy I called the Malkiel Step, buying closed-end investment company shares at a discount from the value of the shares held by the fund. When the first edition of this book was published, discounts on U.S. stocks were as high as 40%. Discounts are far smaller now, as these funds are more efficiently priced. But attractive discounts can arise, especially on international funds and municipal bond funds, and savvy investors can sometimes take advantage. The Malkiel Step is described later in this chapter. The No-Brainer Step, investing in index funds. The Standard & Poor's 500 stock index, a composite that represents about three-quarters of the value of all U.S.-traded common stocks, beats most of the experts over the long pull. Buying a portfolio of all companies in this index would be an easy way to own stocks. I argued back in 1973, in the first edition of this book, that the means to adopt this approach was sorely needed for the small investor. What we need is a no-load, minimum management fee mutual fund that simply buys the hundreds of stocks making up the broad stock market averages and does no trading from security to security in an attempt to catch the winners. Whenever below-average performance on the part of any mutual fund is noticed, fund spokesmen are quick to point out, you can't buy the averages. It's time the public could. Shortly after my book was published, the index fund idea caught on. One of the great virtues of capitalism is that when there is a need for a product, someone usually finds the will to produce it. In 1976, a mutual fund was created that allowed the public to get into the act as well. The Vanguard 500 Index Trust purchased the 500 stocks of the S&P 500 in the same proportions as their weight in the index. Each investor shared proportionately in the dividends and in the capital gains and losses of the fund's portfolio. Today, S&P 500 index funds are available from several mutual fund complexes with expense ratios of about 1/20th of 1% of assets, far less than the expenses incurred by most actively managed mutual funds or bank trust departments. You can now buy the market conveniently and inexpensively. You can also buy exchange-traded S&P 500 index funds offered by State Street Global Advisors, BlackRock, and Vanguard. The logic behind this strategy is the logic of the efficient market hypothesis. But even if markets were not efficient, indexing would still be a very useful investment strategy. Since all the stocks in the market must be owned by someone, it follows that all the investors in the market will earn, on average, the market return. The index fund achieves the market return with minimal expenses. The average actively managed fund incurs an expense ratio of about 1% per year. Thus, the average actively managed fund must underperform the market as a whole by the amount of the expenses that are deducted from the gross return achieved. This would be true even if the market were not efficient. The above-average long-run performance of the S&P 500 compared with that of mutual funds and major institutional investors has been confirmed by numerous studies described in previous chapters of this book. Yes, there are exceptions, but you can count on the fingers of your hands the number of mutual funds that have beaten index funds by any significant margin. The index fund solution. A summary. Let's now summarize the advantages of using index funds as your primary investment vehicle. Index funds have regularly produced rates of return exceeding those of active managers. There are two fundamental reasons for this excess performance: management fees and trading costs. Public index funds and exchange-traded funds are run at fees of 1/20th of 1% or even less. Actively managed public mutual funds charge annual management expenses that average 1 percentage point per year. Moreover, index funds trade only when necessary, whereas active funds typically have a turnover rate close to 100%. Using very modest estimates of trading costs, such turnover is undoubtedly an additional drag on performance. Even if stock markets were less than perfectly efficient, active management as a whole could not achieve gross returns exceeding the market. Therefore, active managers must, on average, underperform the indexes by the amount of these expense and transactions costs disadvantages. Unfortunately, active managers as a group cannot be like the radio personality Garrison Keillor's fictional hometown of Lake Wobegon, where all the children are above average. Index funds are also tax-friendly. Index funds allow investors to defer the realization of capital gains or avoid them completely if the shares are later bequeathed. To the extent that the long-run uptrend in stock prices continues, switching from security to security involves realizing capital gains that are subject to tax. Taxes are a crucially important financial consideration because the earlier realization of capital gains will substantially reduce net returns. Index funds do not trade from security to security and, thus, tend to avoid capital gains taxes. Index funds are also relatively predictable. When you buy an actively managed fund, you can never be sure how it will do relative to its peers. When you buy an index fund, you can be reasonably certain that it will track its index and that it is likely to beat the average manager handily. Moreover, the index fund is always fully invested. You should not believe the active manager who claims that her fund will move into cash at the correct times. We have seen that market timing does not work. Finally, index funds are easier to evaluate. There are now over 5,000 stock mutual funds out there, and there is no reliable way to predict which ones are likely to outperform in the future. With index funds, you know exactly what you are getting, and the investment process is made incredibly simple. Despite all the evidence to the contrary, suppose an investor still believed that superior investment management really does exist. Two issues remain. First, it is clear that such skill is very rare. And second, there appears to be no effective way to find such skill before it has been demonstrated. As I indicated in Chapter 7, the best performing funds in one period of time are not the best performers in the next period. The top performers of the 1990s had dreadful returns in the first decade of the 2000s. Paul Samuelson summed up the difficulty in the following parable. Suppose it was demonstrated that 1 out of 20 alcoholics could learn to become a moderate social drinker. The experienced clinician would answer, "Even if true, act as if it were false, for you will never identify that 1 in 20, and in the attempt, 5 in 20 will be ruined." Samuelson concluded that investors should forsake the search for such tiny needles in huge haystacks. Stock trading among institutional investors is like an isometric exercise. Lots of energy is expended, but between one investment manager and another, it all balances out. And the trading costs the managers incur detract from performance. Like greyhounds at the dog track, professional money managers seem destined to lose their race with the mechanical rabbit. Small wonder that many institutional investors, including Intel, Exxon, Ford, American Telephone and Telegraph, Harvard University, the College Retirement Equity Fund, and the New York State Teachers Association, have put substantial portions of their assets into index funds. By 2014, about one-third of investment funds were indexed. How about you? When you buy an index fund, you give up the chance of boasting at the golf club about the fantastic gains you've made by picking stock market winners. Broad diversification rules out extraordinary losses relative to the whole market. It also, by definition, rules out extraordinary gains. Thus, many Wall Street critics refer to index fund investing as guaranteed mediocrity. But experience shows conclusively that index fund buyers are likely to obtain results exceeding those of the typical fund manager, whose large advisory fees and substantial portfolio turnover tend to reduce investment yields. Many people will find the guarantee of playing the stock market game at par every round a very attractive one. Of course, this strategy does not rule out risk. If the market goes down, your portfolio is guaranteed to follow suit. The index method of investment has other attractions for the small investor. It enables you to obtain very broad diversification with only a small investment. It also allows you to reduce brokerage charges. The index fund, by pooling the monies of many investors, trades in larger blocks and pays minimal fees on its transactions. The index fund does all the work of collecting the dividends from all of the stocks it owns and sending you each quarter one check for all of your earnings, earnings that, incidentally, can be reinvested in the fund if you desire. In short, the index fund is a sensible, serviceable method for obtaining the market's rate of return with absolutely no effort and minimal expense. A broader definition of indexing. The indexing strategy is one that I have recommended since the first edition in 1973, even before index funds existed. It was clearly an idea whose time had come. By far the most popular index used is the Standard & Poor's 500 Stock Index, an index that well represents the major corporations in the U.S. market. But now, although I still recommend indexing, or so-called passive investing, there are valid criticisms of too narrow a definition of indexing. Many people incorrectly equate indexing with a strategy of simply buying the S&P 500 index. That is no longer the only game in town. The S&P 500 omits the thousands of small companies that are among the most dynamic in the economy. Thus, I believe that if an investor is to buy only one U.S. index fund, the best general U.S. index to emulate is one of the broader indexes such as the Russell 3000, the Wilshire 5000 Total Market Index, the CRSP Index, or the MSCI U.S. Broad Market Index, not the S&P 500. 80 years of market history confirm that, in the aggregate, smaller stocks have tended to outperform larger ones. For example, from 1926 to 2014, a portfolio of smaller stocks produced a rate of return of about 12% annually, whereas the returns from larger stocks, such as those in the S&P 500, were about 10%. Although the smaller stocks were riskier than the major blue chips, the point is that a well-diversified portfolio of small companies is likely to produce enhanced returns. For this reason, I favor investing in an index that contains a much broader representation of U.S. companies, including large numbers of the small dynamic companies that are likely to be in early stages of their growth cycles. Recall that the S&P 500 represents 75 to 80% of the market value of all outstanding U.S. common stocks. Literally thousands of companies represent the remaining 20 to 25% of the total U.S. market value. These are, in many cases, the emerging growth companies that offer higher investment rewards as well as higher risks. The Wilshire 5000 Index contains all publicly traded U.S. common stocks. The Russell 3000 and MSCI Index contain all but the smallest and much less liquid stocks in the market. A number of mutual funds are now based on these broader indexes. Such index funds usually go by the name Total Stock Market Portfolio. Although past performance can never assure future results, the evidence clearly indicates that total stock market index funds have provided higher returns than the average equity mutual fund manager. Moreover, unlike charity, indexing need not begin and end at home. As I argued in Chapter 8, investors can reduce risk by diversifying internationally, by including asset classes such as real estate in the portfolio, and by placing some portion of their portfolio in bonds and bond-like securities, including Treasury inflation protection securities. This is the basic lesson of modern portfolio theory. Thus, investors should not buy a U.S. stock market index fund and hold no other securities. But this is not an argument against indexing because index funds currently exist that mimic the performance of various international indexes such as the Morgan Stanley Capital International, MSCI, Index of European, Australasian and Far Eastern, EAFE securities, and the MSCI Emerging Markets Index. In addition, there are index funds holding real estate investment trusts, REITs. Finally, total bond market index funds are available that track the Barclays Aggregate Bond Market Index. Moreover, all these index funds have also tended to outperform actively managed funds investing in similar securities. One of the biggest mistakes that investors make is to fail to obtain sufficient international diversification. The United States represents only about one-third of the world economy. To be sure, a U.S. total stock market fund does provide some global diversification because many of the multinational U.S. companies, such as General Electric and Coca-Cola, do a great deal of their business abroad. But the emerging markets of the world, such as China, India, and Brazil, have been growing much faster than the developed economies. China, for example, is still considered an emerging market. But it is now the second largest economy in the world and is expected by the International Monetary Fund to continue to be the fastest growing large economy in the world and to surpass the United States in size during the second decade of the 21st century. Hence, in the recommendations that follow, you will note that I suggest that a substantial part of every portfolio be invested in emerging markets. Emerging markets are likely to sustain high growth rates well into the 21st century. Emerging markets tend to have younger populations than the developed world. Economies with younger populations tend to grow faster. Moreover, at the end of 2014, they had more attractive valuations than those in the United States. We have pointed out that cyclically adjusted price-earnings ratios, CAPEs, tend to have predictable power in forecasting longer-run equity returns in developed markets. The same relationship holds in emerging markets. Emerging market CAPEs were below 15 in late 2014. Future long-run returns have tended to be generous when stocks could be bought at those valuations. Indexing also is an extremely effective strategy in emerging markets. For instance, the overwhelming majority of actively managed emerging market equity funds are outperformed by the MSCI Emerging Markets Index. Even though emerging markets are not likely to be as efficient as developed markets, they are costly to access and to trade. Expense ratios of active funds are far higher than is the case in developed markets. Moreover, liquidity is lower and trading costs are higher in emerging markets. Therefore, after all expenses are accounted for, indexing turns out to be an excellent investment strategy. A specific index fund portfolio. Here follows specific index fund selections that investors can use to build their portfolios with the recommended percentages for those in their mid-50s, the group I call the aging boomers. Cash, 5%, consisting of Fidelity Money Market Fund or Vanguard Prime Money Market Fund. Bonds and bond substitutes, 27.5%, that's with 7.5% U.S. Vanguard Intermediate Term Bond or iShares Corporate Bond ETF. 7.5% Vanguard Emerging Market Government Bond Fund, 12.5% Wisdom Tree Dividend Growth Fund or Vanguard Dividend Growth Fund. Real Estate Equities, 12.5%, consisting of Vanguard REIT Index Fund or Fidelity Spartan REIT Index Fund. Stocks, 55%, with 27% U.S. stocks, Schwab Total Stock Market Index Fund or Vanguard Total Stock Market Index Fund. 14% Developed International Markets, Schwab International Index Fund, or Vanguard International Index Fund, and 14% Emerging International Markets, Vanguard Emerging Markets Index Fund, or Fidelity Spartan Emerging Markets Index Fund. Those who are not in their mid-50s can use exactly the same selections and simply change the weights to those appropriate for their specific age group. Remember also that you may want to alter the percentages somewhat depending on your personal capacity for and attitude toward risk. Those willing to accept somewhat more risk in the hope of greater reward could increase the proportion of equities. Those who need a steady income for living expenses could increase their holdings of real estate equities and dividend growth stocks because they provide somewhat larger current income. Remember also that I am assuming here that you hold most, if not all, of your securities in tax-advantaged retirement plans. Certainly all bonds should be held in such accounts. If bonds are held outside of retirement accounts, you may well prefer tax-exempt bonds rather than the taxable securities. Moreover, if your common stocks will be held in taxable accounts, you might consider tax-managed index funds. Finally, note that I have given you a choice of index funds from different mutual fund complexes. Because of my long association with the Vanguard Group, I wanted also to suggest a number of non-Vanguard funds. All the funds listed have moderate expense ratios and are no load. ETFs and taxes. One of the advantages noted above of passive portfolio management, that is, simply buying and holding an index fund, is that such a strategy minimizes transactions costs as well as taxes. Taxes are a crucially important financial consideration, as two Stanford University economists, Joel Dixon and John Chauvin, have shown. Utilizing a sample of 62 mutual funds with long-term records, they found that pre-tax, $1 invested in 1962 would have grown to $21.89 in 1992. After paying taxes on income dividends and capital gains distributions, however, that same $1 invested in mutual funds by a high-income investor would have grown to only $9.87. To a considerable extent, index mutual funds help solve the tax problem. Because they do not trade from security to security, they tend to avoid capital gains taxes. Nevertheless, even index funds do realize some capital gains that are taxable to the holders. These gains generally arise involuntarily, either because of a buyout of one of the companies in the index or because sales are forced on the mutual fund. The latter occurs when mutual fund shareholders decide on balance to redeem their shares and the fund must sell securities to raise cash. Thus, even regular index funds are not a perfect solution for the problem of minimizing tax liabilities. Exchange-traded index funds, ETFs, such as SPIDRs, an S&P 500 fund, and VIPRs, a total stock market fund, can be more tax-efficient than regular index funds because they are able to make in-kind redemptions. In-kind redemptions proceed by delivering low-cost shares against redemption requests. This is not a taxable transaction for the fund, so there is no realization of gain that must be distributed to the fund's other shareholders. Moreover, the redeeming ETF shareholder pays taxes based on his or her original cost of the shares, not the fund's basis in the basket of stocks that is delivered. ETFs also happen to have rock-bottom expenses, sometimes even lower than those of equivalent mutual funds. A wide variety of ETFs are available not only for U.S. stocks, but for international ones as well. ETFs are an excellent vehicle for the investment of lump sums that are to be allocated to index funds. ETFs require the payment of transactions costs, however, including brokerage fees and bid-ask spreads. No-load index mutual funds will better serve investors who will be accumulating index shares over time in small amounts. I suggest that you avoid the temptation to buy or sell ETFs at any hour of the day and to buy such funds on margin. I agree with John Bogle, founder of the Vanguard Group, who says, investors cut their own throats when they trade ETFs. If you are so tempted, follow the practice of Little Miss Muffet and run far away from the spiders and their siblings. Here follow the ETFs that can be used to build your portfolio. Total U.S. Stock Market, Vanguard Total Stock Market, or iShares Russell 3000. Developed Markets, EAFE, Vanguard Europe Pacific, or iShares MSCI EAFE. Emerging Markets, Vanguard Emerging Markets, or iShares MSCI Emerging Markets. Total World EXUS, Vanguard FTSE All World EXUS, or SPDR MSCI ACWI EXUS. Total World Including US, Vanguard Total World, or iShares MSCI ACWI. Bond Market US, Vanguard Intermediate Term Corporate Bond, or iShares Investment Grade Corporate Bond. Note that for investors who want to make their stock buying as easy as possible, there are Total World Index Funds and ETFs that provide total international diversification with one-stop shopping. If you want an easy, time-tested method to achieve superior investment results, you can stop listening here. The indexed mutual funds, or ETFs, that I have listed will provide broad diversification, tax efficiency, and low expenses. Even if you want to buy individual stocks, do what institutional investors are increasingly doing: index the core of your portfolio along the lines suggested, and then take active bets with extra funds. With a strong core of index funds, you can take these bets with much less risk than if the whole portfolio were actively managed. And even if you make some errors, they won't prove fatal. The do-it-yourself step. Potentially useful stock-picking rules. Indexing is the strategy I recommend most highly for individuals and institutions. I do recognize, however, that indexing the entire portfolio may be considered by many to be a very dull strategy. Those with speculative temperaments will undoubtedly prefer using their own steps and wits to pick winners, at least for some portion of their investment funds. For those who insist on playing the game themselves, the do-it-yourself step may be appealing. Having been smitten with the gambling urge since childhood, I can well understand why many investors have a compulsion to try to pick the big winners on their own, and a total lack of interest in a system that promises results merely equivalent to those in the market as a whole. The problem is that it takes a lot of work to do it yourself, and consistent winners are very rare. For those who regard investing as play, however, this section demonstrates how a sensible strategy might produce substantial rewards and, at the very least, minimize the risks in playing the stock-picking game. Before putting my strategy to work, however, you need to know the sources of investment information. Most information sources can be obtained at public libraries. You should be an avid reader of the financial pages of daily newspapers, particularly the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. Weeklies such as Barron's should be on your must-read list as well. Business magazines such as Bloomberg Businessweek, Fortune, and Forbes are also valuable for gaining exposure to investment ideas. The major investment advisory services are good, too. You should, for example, try to have access to Standard & Poor's Outlook and the Value Line Investment Survey. The first is a weekly publication that contains recommendations of stocks to buy. The second presents historical records, current reviews, and risk beta ratings of all the major securities. Finally, a wealth of information, including security analysts' recommendations, is available on the Internet. In the first edition of A Random Walk Down Wall Street, over 40 years ago, I proposed four rules for successful stock selection. I find them just as serviceable today. In abridged form, the rules, some of which have been mentioned in earlier chapters, are as follows. Rule 1. Confine stock purchases to companies that appear able to sustain above-average earnings growth for at least 5 years. Difficult as the job may be, picking stocks whose earnings grow is the name of the game. Consistent growth not only increases the earnings and dividends of the company, but may also increase the multiple that the market is willing to pay for those earnings. Thus, the purchaser of a stock whose earnings begin to grow rapidly has a potential double benefit. Both the earnings and the multiple may increase. Rule 2. Never pay more for a stock than can reasonably be justified by a firm foundation of value. Although I am convinced that you can never judge the exact intrinsic value of a stock, I do feel that you can roughly gauge when a stock seems to be reasonably priced. The market price-earnings multiple is a good place to start. Buy stocks selling at multiples in line with or not very much above this ratio. Look for growth situations that the market has not already recognized by bidding the stock's multiple to a large premium. If the growth actually takes place, you will often get a double bonus. Both the earnings and the price-earnings multiple can rise. Beware of stocks with very high multiples and many years of growth already discounted in their prices. If earnings decline rather than grow, you can get double trouble. The multiple will drop along with the earnings. Following this rule would have avoided the heavy losses suffered by investors in the premier high-tech growth stocks that sold at astronomical price-earnings multiples in early 2000. Note that, although similar, this is not simply another endorsement of the buy-low, price-earning stock strategy. Under my rule, it is perfectly all right to buy a stock with a price-earnings multiple slightly above the market average, as long as the company's growth prospects are substantially above average. You might call this an adjusted low price-earning strategy. Some people call this a GARP, GARP, Growth at a Reasonable Price strategy. Buy stocks whose price earnings are low relative to their growth prospects. If you can be even reasonably accurate in picking companies that do indeed enjoy above-average growth, you will be rewarded with above-average returns. Rule 3. It helps to buy stocks with the kinds of stories of anticipated growth on which investors can build castles in the air. I stressed in Chapter 2 the importance of psychological elements in stock price determination. Individual and institutional investors are not computers that calculate warranted price-earnings multiples and then print out buy-and-sell decisions. They are emotional human beings, driven by greed, gambling instinct, hope, and fear in their stock market decisions. This is why successful investing demands both intellectual and psychological acuteness. Of course, the market is not totally subjective either. If a positive growth rate appears to be established, the stock is almost certain to develop some type of following. But stocks are like people. Some have more attractive personalities than others, and the improvement in a stock's multiple may be smaller if its story never catches on. The key to success is being where other investors will be several months before they get there. So ask yourself whether the story about your stock is one that is likely to catch the fancy of the crowd. Can the story generate contagious dreams? Is it a story on which investors can build castles in the air, but castles in the air that really rest on a firm foundation? Rule 4. Trade as little as possible. I agree with the Wall Street maxim, ride the winners and sell the losers, but not because I believe in technical analysis. Frequent switching accomplishes nothing but subsidizing your broker and increasing your tax burden when you do realize gains. I do not say never sell a stock on which you have a gain. The circumstances that led you to buy the stock may change, and, especially when it gets to be tulip time in the market, many of your successful growth stocks may become overweighted in your portfolio, as they did during the Internet bubble of 1999 to 2000. But it is very difficult to recognize the proper time to sell, and heavy tax costs may be involved. My own philosophy leads me to minimize trading as much as possible. I am merciless with the losers, however. With few exceptions, I sell before the end of each calendar year any stocks on which I have a loss. The reason for this timing is that losses are deductible, up to certain amounts, for tax purposes, or can offset gains you may already have taken. Thus, taking losses can lower your tax bill. I might hold a losing position if the growth I expect begins to materialize, and I am convinced that my stock will eventually work out. But I do not recommend too much patience in losing situations, especially when prompt action can produce immediate tax benefits. The efficient market theory warns that following even sensible rules such as these is unlikely to lead to superior performance. Non-professional investors labor under many handicaps. Earnings reports cannot always be trusted. And once a story is out in the regular press, it's likely that the market has already taken account of the information. Picking individual stocks is like breeding thoroughbred porcupines. You study and study and make up your mind, and then proceed very carefully. In the final analysis, much as I hope that investors have achieved successful records following my good advice, I am well aware that the winners in the stock-picking game may have benefited mainly from Lady Luck. For all its hazards, picking individual stocks is a fascinating game. My rules do, I believe, tilt the odds in your favor while protecting you from the excessive risk involved in high multiple stocks. But if you choose this course, remember that a large number of other investors, including the pros, are trying to play the same game. And the odds of anyone's consistently beating the market are pretty slim. Nevertheless, for many of us, trying to outguess the market is a game that is much too much fun to give up. Even if you were convinced you would not do any better than average, I'm sure that most of you, with speculative temperaments, would still want to keep on playing the game of selecting individual stocks with at least some portion of the money you invest. My rules permit you to do so in a way that significantly limits your exposure to risk. If you do want to pick stocks yourself, I strongly suggest a mixed strategy. Index the core of your portfolio and try the stock-picking game for the money you can afford to put at somewhat greater risk. If the main part of your retirement funds is broadly indexed and your stocks are diversified with bonds and real estate, you can safely take a flyer on some individual stocks knowing that your basic nest egg is reasonably secure. Even if you use index funds for all your investments, you might choose to alter the weights of various portfolio components in an attempt to enhance returns. One adjustment that I make in my own indexed portfolio is to overweight China relative to its weight in the World Index benchmark. I do so because I believe that China gets too low a weight relative to its economic importance. Certain peculiarities about China's stock markets lead to China's being underweighted both in emerging markets index funds and in total world indexes. Most indexes are float-weighted. If some of a company's shares do not trade freely, They are not counted in the company's weight in the index. Float weighting means that China gets underweighted for two reasons. First, none of the shares traded in the local Chinese stock markets in Shanghai and Shenzhen get counted, because these shares have been available only to Chinese citizens, with minor exceptions. Only the freely tradable shares of Chinese companies listed in Hong Kong or New York are counted in the index. A second reason China gets underweighted is that the Chinese government owns a huge portion of the shares of many companies, and those shares are not counted in the float. As a result, China gets only about 2% of the weight in the world indexes, whereas, adjusted for purchasing power parity, China's GDP is about 13% of the world's GDP and is growing rapidly. Hence, I believe that investors need to put more China into their portfolios than is available in general world or emerging market index funds. I am, however, true to my indexing beliefs and think the best way to do it is to buy a broad-based index fund of Chinese companies. Three of them that trade on the New York Stock Exchange are Yao, an index fund representing all Chinese companies available to international investors, Hao, a small capitalization index fund that contains more entrepreneurial companies and ones with less government ownership, and Dao, a Chinese real estate fund. The substitute player step, hiring a professional Wall Street walker. There's an easier way to gamble in your investment walk. Instead of trying to pick the individual winners, stocks, pick the best coaches, investment managers. These coaches come in the form of active mutual fund managers, and there are thousands of them for you to pick from. In previous editions of this book, I provided the names of several investment managers who had enjoyed long-term records of successful portfolio management, as well as brief biographies explaining their investment styles. These managers were among the very few who had shown an ability to beat the market over long periods of time. I have abandoned that practice in the current edition for two reasons. First, with the exception of Warren Buffett, those managers have now retired from active portfolio management, and Buffett himself was well above retirement age in 2014. Second, I have become increasingly convinced that the past records of mutual fund managers are essentially worthless in predicting future success. The few examples of consistently superior performance occur no more frequently than can be expected by chance. Assuming that you prefer to invest in an actively managed equity mutual fund, is it really possible to select a fund that will be a top performer? One plausible method, favored by many financial planners and editors, is to choose funds with the best recent performance records. The financial pages of newspapers and magazines are filled with fund advertisements claiming that a particular fund is number one in performance. There are at least two problems with this approach. First, many fund advertisements are quite misleading. The number one ranking is typically for a self-selected, specific time period and compared with a particular, usually small, group of common stock funds. For example, one fund advertised itself as now ranked number one for performance, the fund that's performed through booms, busts, and 11 presidential elections. It is implied that this fund was a top performer over a period of 44 years. The truth of the matter, revealed in a small footnote referenced by the asterisk, was that the fund was number one only during one specific three-month period, and only compared with a specific category of funds with asset values between $250 million, and $500 million. The more important reason to be skeptical of past performance records is that, as I have mentioned earlier, there is no consistent long-run relationship between performance in one period and investment results in the next. I have studied the persistence of mutual fund performance over more than 40 years and conclude that it is simply impossible for investors to guarantee themselves above-average returns by purchasing those funds with the best recent records. Although there have been a few examples, such as Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway, of fairly consistent long-run superb performance, the general result is that there is no dependable long-term persistence. You can't assure yourself of superior performance by buying mutual funds that may have beaten the market in some past period. Once again, the past does not predict the future. I have tested a strategy whereby at the start of each year, investors would rank all general equity funds on the basis of the fund's records over the past 12 months. In alternative strategies, I have assumed that the investor buys the top 10 funds, the top 20 funds, and so on. There is no way to beat the market consistently by purchasing the mutual funds that have performed best in the past. I also tested a strategy of purchasing the best funds as ranked by the leading financial magazines. The clear implication of these tests in the laboratory of fund performance, as well as the academic work reported in Part 2 of this book, is that you cannot depend on an excellent record continuing persistently in the future. Indeed, it's often the case that the hot performers of one period are the dogs of the next. The Morningstar Mutual Fund Information Service. If recent performance is not a reliable indicator in choosing a mutual fund, what is? I have often said that the two best things that have happened to the mutual fund industry are the arrival of Jack Bogle, who started the low-cost, consumer-friendly Vanguard group of mutual funds during the mid-1970s, and Don Phillips, who in the early 1990s initiated the extremely useful Morningstar service, which publishes information on mutual funds. Basically, Morningstar is one of the most comprehensive sources of mutual fund information an investor can find. For each mutual fund, it publishes a report crammed full of relevant data. Its reports show past returns, risk ratings, portfolio composition, and the fund's investment style. For example, the fund invests in established large companies or smaller growth companies, favors value stocks with low price-earnings ratios, buys foreign or domestic stocks or both, and so on. The reports indicate whether the fund has any sales charges, load fees, and show the annual expense ratios for the fund and the percentage of the fund's asset value represented by unrealized appreciation. If you buy actively managed funds, you should look for no-load, low-turnover, low-expense funds with little unrealized appreciation to minimize future tax liability. For bond funds, Morningstar gives data on returns, effective maturity, quality of bonds held, and information on loads and expenses. The Morningstar service also uses a 5-star rating system. It rates past performance, taking into account broad market returns and the costs and risks associated with getting those returns. The top funds are given 5 stars, 2 more than Michelin assigns to the top restaurants in the world. The stars are useful in categorizing past performance. Unlike the Michelin stars, which virtually guarantee the diner a meal of the designated quality, however, the Morningstar ratings do not guarantee an investor continued superior performance. In the past, 5-star funds have not done better than 3-star or even 1-star funds. The wise investor will look beyond the stars in making appropriate investment decisions. Is there any way to select an actively managed fund that is likely to be an above-average performer? I have undertaken many studies of mutual fund returns over the years in an attempt to explain why some funds perform better than others. As indicated earlier, past performance is not helpful in predicting future returns. The two variables that do the best job in predicting future performance are expense ratios and turnover. High expenses and high turnover depress returns, especially after-tax returns if the funds are held in taxable accounts. The best-performing actively managed funds have moderate expense ratios and low turnover. The lower the expenses charged by the purveyor of the investment service, the more there will be for the investor. As Jack Bogle, the founder of the Vanguard Group, puts it, in the mutual fund business, you get what you don't pay for. I suggest that investors never buy actively managed funds with expense ratios above 50 basis points, 0.5%, and with turnover of more than 50%. Expense ratios and turnover statistics are available on the fund's websites and from investment sources such as Morningstar. The Malkiel Step. As readers of previous editions know, I like to buy shares in a special type of investment fund called a closed-end fund, officially a closed-end investment company, when they are available at attractive discounts. Closed-end funds differ from open-end mutual funds, the kind discussed in the preceding section, in that they neither issue nor redeem shares after the initial offering. To buy or sell shares, you have to go to a broker. The price of the shares depends on what other investors are willing to pay for them. However, unlike shares in open-end funds or in ETFs, this price is not necessarily related to net asset value. Thus, a closed-end fund can sell at a premium above or at a discount from its net asset value. During much of the 1970s and at the start of the 1980s, these funds were selling at substantial discounts from their net asset value. Closed-end funds hire professional managers, and their expenses are no higher than those of ordinary mutual funds. So for those who believe in professional investment management, here was a way to buy it at a discount, and I told my readers so. The beauty of buying these highly discounted closed-end funds was that even if the discounts remained at high levels, investors would still reap extraordinary rewards from their purchase. If you could buy shares at a 25% discount, you would have $4 of asset value on which dividends could be earned for every $3 you invested. So even if the funds just equaled the market return, as believers in the random walk would expect, you would beat the averages. It was like having a $100 savings account paying 5% interest. You'd deposit $100 and earn $5 interest each year. Only this savings account could be bought at a 25% discount. In other words, for $75. You still got $5 interest, 5% of $100, but because you paid only $75 for the account, your rate of return was 6.67%, 5 divided by 75. Note that this increase in yield was in no way predicated on the discount narrowing. Even if you got only $75 back when you cashed in, you would still have received a big bonus in extra returns while holding the account. The discount on closed-end funds provided a similar bonus. You got your share of dividends from $1 worth of assets, even though you paid only 75 cents. The strategy worked even better than expected. Discounts have narrowed significantly on U.S. closed-end funds, although the publicity given closed-end funds in my books may have helped to close the discounts. I think the fundamental reason for the narrowing is that our capital markets are reasonably efficient. The market may misvalue assets from time to time, creating temporary inefficiencies. But if there is truly some area of pricing inefficiency that can be discovered by the market and dependably exploited, then value-seeking investors will take advantage of these opportunities and thereby eliminate them. Pricing irregularities may well exist and even persist for periods of time, but the financial laws of gravity will eventually take hold and true value will out. With their discounts for the most part dried up at the time this edition goes to press, most domestic U.S. closed-end funds are no longer an especially attractive investment opportunity. Indeed, when you buy a new closed-end fund at par value plus about 5% for underwriting commissions, not only do you get hit with the equivalent of a large loading fee, but you also run the risk that the fund will sell at a discount at some time in the future. Never buy a closed-end fund at its initial offering price. It will almost invariably turn out to be a bad deal. It may be worth checking, however, to see whether discounts widen in the future during unsettled market conditions. But discounts exist for some international funds, funds investing in emerging markets, and funds investing in municipal bonds. Diversified portfolios of emerging market closed-end funds selling at discounts are a viable and probably a preferable alternative to an emerging market index fund. When discounts of 10% or more exist, it is time to open your wallet to closed-end funds. There are also closed-end funds that hold tax-exempt municipal bonds. These funds have tended to sell at discounts at times when investors have been concerned about the creditworthiness of municipal securities. Worries about the indebtedness of Puerto Rico and the Detroit bankruptcy led to lower prices and higher yields for all state and local government securities. Those concerns also led to lower prices and bigger discounts for closed-end municipal bond funds. In 2014, many of these funds sold at discounts of 10% or more, and they provided investors with yields between 6 and 7%. The yield on regular long-term municipal bond funds was between 3.5% and 4% in 2014. The closed-end funds enhanced their yields by using moderate leverage. they borrow monies at very low short-term interest rates to buy higher-yielding long-term bonds. This increases their yields above those of mutual bond funds that do not use leverage. This is not a free lunch. Leverage increases the potential volatility and thus the riskiness of the closed-end funds. A paradox. Although some emerging market closed-end funds appeared attractive during 2014, domestic funds holding U.S. equities were no longer selling at the bargain basement levels that existed in earlier periods. This illustrates an important paradox about investment advice, as well as the maxim that true values do eventually prevail in the market. There is a fundamental paradox about the usefulness of investment advice concerning specific securities. If the advice reaches enough people and they act on it, knowledge of the advice destroys its usefulness. If everyone knows about a good buy, and everyone rushes in to buy, the price of the good buy will rise until it is no longer a good buy. This is the main logical pillar on which the efficient market theory rests. If the spread of news is unimpeded, prices will react quickly so that they reflect all that is known. This led me to predict in the 1981 edition that favorable discounts would not always be available. I wrote, "I would be very surprised to see the early 1980s levels of discounts perpetuate themselves indefinitely." For the same reason, I am skeptical that any simple popular investment techniques will be persistently successful. I have recounted the story of the finance professor and his students who spotted a $100 bill lying on the street. "If it was really a $100 bill," the professor reasoned out loud, "someone would have already picked it up." Fortunately, the students were skeptical, not only of Wall Street professionals, but also of learned professors, and so they picked up the money. Clearly, there is considerable logic to the finance professor's position. In markets where intelligent people are searching for value, it is unlikely that people will perpetually leave $100 bills around ready for the taking. But history tells us that unexploited opportunities do exist from time to time, as do periods of speculative excess pricing. We know of Dutchmen paying astronomical prices for tulip bulbs, of Englishmen splurging on the most improbable bubbles, and of modern institutional fund managers who convinced themselves that some internet stocks were so unlike any other that any price was reasonable. And when investors were overcome with pessimism, real fundamental investment opportunities such as closed-end funds were passed by. Yet eventually, excessive valuations were corrected, and investors did snatch up the bargain closed-end funds. Perhaps the finance professor's advice should have been, "You had better pick up that $100 bill quickly, because if it's really there, someone else will surely take it." It is in this sense that I consider myself a random walker. I am convinced that true value will out, but from time to time it doesn't surprise me that anomalies do exist. There may be some $100 bills around at times, and I'll certainly interrupt my random walk to stoop and pick them up. Investment advisors. If you follow the recommendations in this book carefully, you really don't need an investment advisor. Unless you have a variety of tax complications or legal issues, you should be able to accomplish the diversification required and do the rebalancing yourself. You might even find that it is fun to be able to take complete charge of your investment program. The problem with investment advisors is that they tend to be quite expensive and are often conflicted. Many investment advisors will charge you 1% per year or more to manage your investment affairs. Brokers will frequently charge even more, costing you 2 or 3% per year in fees. As I suspect we are likely to live in a single-digit investment environment for some time, such high fees will do great harm to your net investment returns. Many investment advisors are also often conflicted. Some will put you into certain funds that give extra kickbacks to the advisors. In other words, the advisors are actually paid to distribute the funds to you. Such funds may not be in your interest. Indeed, they tend to carry very high expense ratios. If you feel you must get an investment advisor, make sure that advisor is a fee-only advisor. These advisors do not get paid for distributing investment products and thus are more likely to make decisions that are completely in your interest rather than in their interest. If you feel that selecting a properly diversified set of investment products and rebalancing them over time, as I have suggested on these pages, is too much work, there is a low-cost alternative. I warn you at the outset that the service I am suggesting is one where I am the chief investment officer and I therefore want to make my own conflict of interest crystal clear. The firm is called Wealthfront. It is the largest and fastest-growing automated investment service. Everything is done online. Wealthfront features a selection of broadly diversified exchange-traded index funds selected to be extremely low cost. The overall investment fee is only 0.25% per year, and all brokerage fees are included. Wealthfront automatically rebalances the portfolio and even offers a tax loss harvesting program. If one of the ETFs in the diversified set of investments in your portfolio has declined, Wealthfront will sell it at a loss and replace it with a similar but not identical investment vehicle. Thus, rather than costing you a potentially significant tax bill at the end of the year, as many actively managed funds do, Wealthfront actually can provide you with some capital losses that can be used to offset capital gains or capital gain distributions, and up to a limited amount can be deducted from your tax bill. Wealthfront can be contacted at www.wealthfront.com for more details. Some last reflections on our walk. We are now at the end of our walk. Let's look back for a moment and see where we have been. It is clear that the ability to beat the averages consistently is extremely rare. Neither fundamental analysis of a stock's firm foundation of value nor technical analysis of the market's propensity for building castles in the air can produce reliably superior results. Even the pros must hide their heads in shame when they compare their results with those obtained by the dartboard method of picking stocks. Sensible investment policies for individuals must then be developed in two steps. First, it is crucially important to understand the risk-return trade-offs that are available and to tailor your choice of securities to your temperament and requirements. Part 4 provided a careful guide for this part of the walk, including a number of warm-up exercises concerning everything from tax planning to the management of reserve funds and a life-cycle guide to portfolio allocations. This chapter has covered the major part of our walk down Wall Street, three important steps for buying common stocks. I began by suggesting sensible strategies that are consistent with the existence of reasonably efficient markets. The indexing strategy is the one I recommend most highly. At least the core of every investment portfolio ought to be indexed. I recognized, however, that telling most investors that there is no hope of beating the averages is like telling a six-year-old that there is no Santa Claus. It takes the zing out of life. For those of you incurably smitten with the speculative bug who insist on picking individual stocks in an attempt to beat the market, I offered 4 rules. The odds are really stacked against you, but you may just get lucky and win big. I also am very skeptical that you can find investment managers who have some talent for finding those rare $100 bills lying around in the marketplace. Never forget that past records are far from reliable guides to future performance. Investing is a bit like lovemaking. Ultimately, it is really an art requiring a certain talent and the presence of a mysterious force called luck. Indeed, luck may be 99% responsible for the success of the very few people who have beaten the averages, although men flatter themselves with their great actions. La Rochefoucauld wrote, "They are not so often the result of great design as of chance." The game of investing is like lovemaking in another important respect, too. It's much too much fun to give up. If you have the talent to recognize stocks that have good value, and the art to recognize a story that will catch the fancy of others, it's a great feeling to see the market vindicate you. Even if you are not so lucky, my rules will help you limit your risks and avoid much of the pain that is sometimes involved in the playing. If you know you will either win or at least not lose too much, and if you index at least the core of your portfolio, you will be able to play the game with more satisfaction. At the very least, I hope this book makes the game all the more enjoyable. A final word. One of the most rewarding features for me in writing 11 editions of this book has been the many letters I have received from grateful investors. They tell me how much they have benefited from following the simple advice that has remained the same for over 40 years. Those timeless lessons involve broad diversification, annual rebalancing, using index funds, and staying the course. The first decade of the new millennium was one of the most challenging times for investors. Even a broadly diversified total stock market fund devoted solely to U.S. stocks lost money. But even in this horrible decade, following the timeless lessons I have espoused would have produced satisfactory results. An investment in the VTSMX, the Vanguard Total Stock Market Fund, did not produce positive returns in the lost decade of the noughties. But suppose an investor diversified her portfolio with the approximate conservative percentages I suggested before for the aging baby boomers. The diversified portfolio, annually rebalanced, produced a quite satisfactory return even during one of the worst decades investors have ever experienced. And if the investor also used dollar-cost averaging to add small amounts to the portfolio consistently over time, the results were even better. If you will follow the simple rules and timeless lessons espoused in this book, you are likely to do just fine, even during the toughest of times. The End. This is George Waddell. We hope you have enjoyed this production of A Random Walk Down Wall Street by Burton G. Malkiel. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, classics, histories, and more, so look for us at your public library or on download sites online. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.